Chapter 26. If I didn't do something, another woman was going to die, and a couple of kids were going to become orphans. Of course, I also had a gun in my face. If I did do something, I would die. The smart thing would be to let Trixie finish delaying me and wait for her to leave. Emma would be dead, but I'd have at least 12 hours in which I could shut the Evil Eye franchise down. If I didn't cooperate, Emma and I would both die, and the bad guys would still be at large. So the smart money was on staying put. Simple logic. But there are things older than logic, like instinct. One of the most primal instincts in the human soul is the desire to protect children from harm. Even if the idea of Emma's death hadn't been motivation enough, the very thought of how savagely this stupid, venal, selfish harpy might scar Emma's children made me want to call down fire enough to roast Trixie Vixen and her sculpted ass to ash. I found myself tensing to go after her and damn the gun. It wasn't as brainless as you might think. Killing is not so easy as it seems. Most people are wired to be careful of their fellow human beings. Soldiers and cops both are specifically given training to overcome that instinct, and the criminals who fire at other people are usually driven to it by desperation. And even trained soldiers and hardened criminals are often wildly inaccurate. Billy the Kid once emptied his Colt revolver at a bank teller from less than 3 feet away and missed him 6 times. I'd seen a police reel of a cop who had been forced to draw and fire at a suspect, and he'd emptied a full clip at the man from less than 20 feet, missing him every time. Trixie may have had the gun, but she didn't have experience, training, or much in the way of composure. If she hesitated, even for a fraction of a second, it would be possible for me to close on her. If she didn't hesitate, the odds against me were not unthinkably high. It was possible that she might miss me enough times to let me take the gun. Of course, it was possible she'd put a bullet through my eye, too, or through my throat, or maybe my guts. I felt a sudden ethereal wind, cold and ugly. The curse was almost there, and it was deadlier, more potent than ever before. A bare second of concentration told me that I would have no prayer of blocking that much magic, and even redirecting so much raw power would be nearly impossible. I don't know what had happened to make the curse that much stronger, that much deadlier, and it scared me half out of my mind. I had to do something, and I had to do it now. I needed a distraction, but the best I could do was to abruptly whip my head toward the door and to shift my weight as if I might stand up. "Don't move," Trixie snarled. I licked my lips, staring at the door. I saw her expression become uncertain. She rubbernecked toward the door, only for a second, but it would have to do. I threw my still-steaming coffee at her. It sloshed across her shoulder and neck. She screamed in surprise and sudden pain. I lunged at her, lifting the handset of the telephone to swing at her head. She cried out and stared at me, her lovely face stunned, terrified. The Quixote reflexes kicked in. I hesitated. The gun went off from 2 feet away. I recovered before I could lose much momentum and slammed into her, a full body impact that drove her shoulder blades up against the wall beside the door. The gun roared again, and the sharp, acrid tang of cordite and the syrupy smell of blood flooded over me. I got my fingers around the wrist of her gun hand and slammed it against the wall. The gun barked some more, but finally tumbled from her fingers to the floor. I kicked it across the room. Trixie clawed at my eyes with the nails of her free hand. Pain jolted through me. I got an arm around her waist and threw her bodily away from me, opposite the way I had kicked the weapon. She hit the table and folded over it, scattering a box of donuts and a plate of various fruits. Then she sank to the floor, sobbing. One of her stockings had been soaked in blood from ankle to calf, and she curled up, clutching at her wounded leg. I recovered the gun without touching the handle, checked, and found it empty. I turned my eyes to Trixie Vixen. She shrank away from me, weeping in pain and terror. She held up her other arm as a useless shield.
No. No, please. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it.
The adrenaline rushed through me, wild and mindless. I wanted to kill her. A lot. I hadn't ever felt that before. A sudden surge of fury, contempt, and disdain mixed in with a physical excitement only a few degrees short of actual arousal. It wasn't an emotion. It was nothing that tame and limited. It was a force, a dark and vast tide that picked me up and swept me along like a styrofoam packing peanut. And I liked it. There was something in me that took a deep and gloating satisfaction in seeing my enemy on the floor and helpless. That part of me wanted to see her screaming, and then see her die screaming. I'm not sure how I kept myself from acting on that flood of violence and lust. But instead of gut-shooting Trixie, I stared coldly at her for a second, studying her injuries. One of the shots must have either bounced into her calf or entered directly when the gun had gone off during the struggle. She bled, but not enough to kill her anytime soon, and the lines of her calf and foot seemed twisted, slightly misshapen. The bullet must have broken a bone.
Please, she babbled, staring at the gun I now held. I'll do whatever you want. Just say it. Oh, God, please don't kill me.
I stalked to the door. I noted a couple of bullet holes in it and heard myself speak, my voice quiet and deadly cold. Shut up. She did, shuddering with sobs, hiding her face. The scent of urine joined the other smells in the room. I kept her revolver in hand and jerked the door open hard to rush through it and back to the soundstage to deal with the curse. I didn't have to bother. Emma's corpse lay on its back in the hall outside. She had been wearing spandex biking shorts with a matching sports halter. There was blood forming a pool beneath her. A small, neat hole directly into her sternum accompanied a hole in her forehead just over her right eyebrow. She lay with her knees bent beneath her, her arms spread a little. A prescription bottle lay on the ground, just barely touching one fingertip. She'd been dead before she fell, and her body had simply relaxed bonelessly to the ground. The shots couldn't have been more perfect if they'd been delivered by a professional assassin. The odds against stray bullets randomly hitting where they had were inconceivably high. The Malocchio had killed her. The stray bullets had simply been its instrument. I heard Trixie gasp behind me and turned to see her staring at the body.
No,
she whispered, the timing of the word somehow disjointed and random.
That wasn't in the plan. This wasn't part of it. He never said that.
I heard running footsteps coming down the hall and looked up in time to see a couple of the camera guys, Jake and Arturo, round the corner. They came to an abrupt stop, staring at the scene in shock. Someone, Jake, I thought, let out a high-pitched, squawking cry. I suddenly realized that I was standing over a dead woman while another bled from a bullet wound 10 feet away, and that I was holding the gun that did it to them both. Trixie's eyes widened as if she recognized the opportunity. Her mouth twisted into a sudden, vindictive, mad-eyed rictus. She let out a scream, wailing,
Help me! Help me! Oh, God! Don't let him kill me, too!
I didn't have long to decide on a course of action, but I got the benefit of one of those crystallized moments when nothing happens and it seems like you've got all the time in the world to think. I'd been too slow, and now Emma was dead. Worse yet, I looked guilty as hell, short term. In the long term, forensics would show that Trixie had been holding the gun when it went off, but I had never been on good terms with the largest part of Chicago's legal system, either in the courts or law enforcement. At least one cop, now in internal affairs, would be glad to take this opportunity to crucify me, and if I took my chances with the law, the weapon plus the eyewitness testimony of a would-be victim could provide the state with a reasonable case. Even if they didn't win, I could still spend the duration in prison, months or possibly years, until the case was decided. But all it would really take was 1 or 2 days. By then, Mavra and her scourge would find me and kill me. I knew from bloody experience that not even the strongest jail cell meant much to supernatural beings with murder in mind. I still didn't know who was helping Trixie. If I didn't figure out who was behind this mess, they could keep going, keep on killing. If I was out of the picture, they'd get away with it. And the thought stirred up my rage once more. Emma's death had changed things. Before, there had been danger, but no one had died on my watch. Not for lack of trying, sure, but I'd been there in time to avert any deaths. But now, Emma, whose worst crime probably had a lot to do with providing a decent living for her children, was lying there like so much meat, and her kids had no mommy. I stared at Trixie for a hot, wild second, and the look choked her continued shrieks to whimpers. Trixie may have been female, but as of that moment, she wasn't a woman anymore. She'd crossed a line. As far as I was concerned, she and her allies had forfeited their membership card to the Humanity Club when they killed Emma. And I'd be damned if I was going to let them get away with it. But I couldn't do it from the inside of a cell. I turned and hurried into an adjoining hall and toward the nearest door, but found it locked. I cursed and ran back, heading for the front door. Someone shouted, but I ignored them. I sprinted the last 20 feet and was about to hit the door when it abruptly swung open. Joan stepped in from the parking lot, panting. She wore old jeans and another flannel shirt over a tee. She had her keys in one hand and a claw hammer in the other. She'd gone through the locked door and beaten me to the exit. "What are you doing?" she demanded. I checked over my shoulder. I heard more shouts and running footsteps, heavy and fast. Bobby was running after me. If he tried to stop me here in the hall, I didn't think I could get away from him without hurting him, maybe badly. But when I took another step toward Joan, she swallowed, her face pale with fright, but her eyes determined, and lifted the claw hammer. "Joan," I panted, "I have to go." "No," she said. "I don't know what's going on, but I can't let you leave. I heard gunshots. Emma and Trish are hurt." I didn't have time to discuss it. I took a handkerchief from my pocket, wrapped it around the handle of Trixie's gun to maybe preserve any prints, and lifted it, not quite pointing it at Joan. "There's not time to explain, but if you don't let me go, it's going to keep happening. Someone else on the crew will get hurt tonight." Her expression became angry. "Don't you dare threaten these people." "It isn't a threat," I half screamed. I hated to do it, but I pointed the gun at her. "Move!" She started shaking, but adjusted her grip on the hammer and shook her head. "I mean it," I said, and took a step forward, radiating as much menace as I knew how. Joan stared at the gun for a moment. Then an expression of resolution took the fear from her face. She lowered the hammer and took a step toward me, putting the barrel of the gun about 6 inches from her sternum. "I can't let you hurt anyone else. If you want to leave," she said quietly, "you'll have to kill me too." I stared at her for a moment. Then I gripped the gun's barrel with my left hand, left the handkerchief around the handle, and offered it to her. She stared at me. "What are you doing?" "Take it," I said. "Trixie's fingerprints are on the handle, so don't touch it. She was the shooter. She's working with someone, and they're responsible for all the deaths and injuries lately. But when the cops show, she'll lie to them, and it looks bad for me. If the police arrest and hold me, I won't be able to help you when they strike again tonight. I have to go." She shivered and took the gun. She held it like it might bite her. "I don't understand." "Joan, if I was the one who shot them, I'd have shot you too. Would I give you the gun if I'd done it? Just leave the murder weapon here for the cops?" She hesitated, uncertain. "Help me," I told her. There was a tense note of fear in my voice. "I need to get back to my place, get a few things, and go before the cops start watching it. try to delay them. Just for 5 minutes, please. My God, it's going to happen again if I don't stop it. She glanced over her shoulder at the door. Please, Joan, I said quietly. God, please help me. Silence fell heavily, except for more footsteps coming closer. I must be insane, she said. I must be insane. She stepped aside. I did the only thing I could under the circumstances. It made me look guilty as hell, but if I wanted to keep breathing, I didn't have much choice. I ran. Chapter 27. I hit the parking lot at a run, piled into the Blue Beetle, and started it up. Behind me, I heard the building's fire alarm go off, a deafening ringing of emergency bells. In addition to the police, and probably an ambulance, a bunch of fire trucks were about to show up as well. It was going to be one hell of a mess to sort through, at least for the CPD. By the time they made sure the building had been evacuated, seen to Trixie's wound, and taken statements from everyone in the building, I could probably walk to Havana. She'd bought me at least 10 minutes, and probably more. Bless you, Joan, I muttered. I slapped the old car into reverse and cleared out, heading for my apartment. I was on the highway and gone before any sirens started converging. I drove carefully and under the limit, since getting pulled over for a citation could be fatal, and tried to think unobtrusive thoughts. But I found myself mulling over the details of the Molochio. Trixie Vixen had been in the room with me when the last curse came down, and while she was clearly involved, it hadn't come from her. She'd known about it in great detail, though, and she'd known enough about magic to screw up the hurried wards I'd raised around the studio. Couple that with bragging about her power, and I figured she'd been involved in the actual magic at some point. She probably had handled part of the ritual that brought the curse down. It made sense. Trixie was a jumbo-sized, self-obsessed drama queen, complete with melodramatic dialogue, tantrums, and smug confidence that she was the center of the universe. The deaths and near-deaths from the Molochio had given new depth to the term freak accident. Swarms of bees, bridge-jumping cars, and electrocution in a puddle of one's own blood were some pretty ridiculous ways to kill someone. And that frozen turkey thing had come straight out of a cartoon. They would have been funny if it hadn't been for the deaths. But the curse had been different today. No winding, slow build-up, no murder weapons manufactured by the Acme Corporation, and no spillover onto other people nearby. Unlike the others, Emma's death had been the result of a surgical strike of focused, violent energy. The earlier editions of the curse had been more like a stone-headed hatchet than a scalpel. Today's curse had been far stronger than the ones I'd felt before, too. And Trixie was the lowest common denominator. Any kind of magic spell requires certain things to happen. You have to gather in the energy for whatever it is you're trying to do. Then you have to shape it with your thoughts and feelings into what you want it to do. And finally, you have to release it in the direction you want it to go. To use a rough metaphor, you have to load the gun, aim it, and pull the trigger. The problem was that with a curse that powerful, you were talking about a very big gun. Even with a ritual supplying the power for it, controlling that power was a task that not just anybody could do. Aiming and pulling the trigger were easier, but handling them all at once would be very difficult, even for some wizards. That's why for the big projects, you need 3 people working together, and it's the basis for the stereotype of 3 cackling witches casting spells in concert over a cauldron. Trixie stormed off the set before the curse had come at Inari last night, and she hadn't been in the studio when it happened 12 hours prior to that. But she had been there with me today. Trixie, the drama queen's personality, was stamped all over the near-insane deaths, but I was damn sure she wasn't a wizard. Therefore, she'd had help. Someone would need to manage the energy while Trixie shaped the curse into some kind of ludicrous death scenario. And someone else had to pull the trigger, channeling the spell to its intended recipient, also something that required a little more skill and focus than I was willing to believe Trixie had. So, it would take three of them. Three Stregas. Three former Mrs. Arturo Genosas. The curse that killed Emma had been different. It had been a hell of a lot stronger, for one thing, and it had come at her a hell of a lot faster. And the death it had brought down on her had been efficient and quick. If Trixie wasn't with them, then it meant that either one of the others had some serious skill, or they'd been able to find a replacement witch who had been content with making the murder swift, clean, and simple. Four killers working together. I was the only one around who could get in their way, and they knew I was getting closer to them. Under the circumstances, they had only one logical target for the next iteration of the spell, 12 hours from now. Me. That was assuming, of course, that Mavra and the vampire Scourge, or possibly the man I'd hired to help me kill them, didn't take me out first. Maybe they wouldn't get their chance. See, that's the power of positive thinking. I got back to my apartment and got out of the car just in time to see Mister flying down the sidewalk as fast as he could run. He looked both ways before crossing the street, and we entered the apartment together. I started gathering things and shoving them into a nylon gym bag, then opened the door down to the lab. Bob flowed out of Mister, who promptly shuffled over to the fire and collapsed into sleep. "Well," I called down as I finished packing the bag, "did you find her?"
"Yeah, I found her,"
Bob called.
"About time," I said. I went down the ladder in a hurry and flicked several candles alight with a muttered word. I got out a roll of parchment about a foot and a half square. Then I spread it onto the work table in the lab's center and set a fountain pen beside it.
"Where?"
"Not far from Cabrini Green," Bob said. "I got a good look around the place."
"Good. You've got permission to come out long enough to show me what you found." He made a sighing sound, but didn't complain. The usual cloud of glowing orange motes of light slid out of the skull's eye sockets, though perhaps it was a little less bright and swirly than usual. The cloud of light surrounded the pen, and it rose up of its own accord, then began scratching a drawing of the lair on the parchment. Bob's voice, a little indistinct now, said,
"You aren't going to like this."
"Why not?"
"It's a shelter."
"A homeless shelter?"
"Yeah,"
Bob said. "Does some rehab work with drug addicts, too." "Stars and stones," I murmured. "How could vampires take something that public?"
"There's no real threshold on a public building, so they didn't need an invitation. I think they probably came in from Undertown, right into the shelter's basement."
"How many people have they hurt?" Bob's pen flickered over the parchment. "When I draw maps, I usually end up with a series of lopsided squares and wavery lines and incomplete circles. Bob's drawing looked like it could have been done by Da Vinci."
"There were three bodies stacked up in a corner of the basement," Bob said. "A few of the shelter's staff had been made into rough thralls and are covering for them, sort of. Maybe half a dozen people hadn't been enthralled, but they were tied up and locked into a cedar closet."
"Any goons?"
"Big time. Half a dozen Renfields, and each of them has a Darkhound to boot."
"Renfields?" I asked.
"How in the world can you exist in this century and not know about Renfields?" Bob demanded. "You need a life, stat."
"I read the book. I know who Renfield was. I'm not familiar with the parlance for Renfield in the plural."
"Oh," Bob said. "What do you need to know?"
"Well, first off, what did they call them before Stoker published the book?" I asked.
"They didn't call them anything, Harry," Bob said in a tone of gentle patience. "That's why the White Court had Stoker publish the book, to tell people about them."
"Oh, right," I rubbed at my eyes. "How do the vampires do their recruiting?"
"Mind control magic," Bob said. "The usual."
"Always with the mental control," I muttered. "Let me make sure my facts are straight. Rough thralls just stand around looking blank until they get orders, right?"
"Yeah," Bob said, pen scratching. "Sort of like zombies, but they still have to go to the bathroom."
"So a Renfield is the fine version of thraldom?"
"No," Bob said. "A fine thrall is so controlled that they might not even know that they're a thrall at all, and it lasts long term."
Like what De Morne did to Elaine?
I guess so, yeah, like that. That kind of thing takes a subtle hand, though. Enthralling someone also requires a lot of time and a certain amount of empathy, neither of which has been readily available to Mavra.
So, I said, getting impatient, a Renfield is a...
Bob put the pen down.
It's the quick, dirty way for the Black Court to pick up some cheap muscle. Renfields have been crushed into total thraldom through brute psychic force.
You're kidding, I said. The kind of mental damage that would do to someone.
It destroys their sanity when it happens, Bob confirmed. Makes them no good for anything but gibbering violence. But since that's pretty much what the vampires wanted to begin with, it works out.
How do you get them out of it? I asked.
You don't, Bob said. The original Merlin couldn't undo it, and neither could any of the saints on record to have tried. A thrall can be freed, or recover over time. Renfields can't. From the moment their minds break, they've got an expiration date.
Ugh, I said. What do you mean?
Renfields get more and more violent and deranged, and they self-destruct in a year or two. You can't fix them. For all practical purposes, they're already dead.
I went over the facts in my mind and admired how much uglier the situation had just become. Over the years, I've learned that ignorance is more than just bliss. It's freaking orgasmic ecstasy. I glanced at Bob and said, "Are you sure about your facts?"
The cloud of orange light flowed tiredly back into the skull on its shelf.
Yes, De Morne did quite a bit of research on the subject back in the day.
Murphy isn't going to like this, I said.
Dismembering monsters with a chainsaw is one thing. People are another.
Yeah, people are easier.
Bob, I growled. They're people.
Renfields aren't, Harry, Bob said. They might still be moving around, but they're pretty much gone.
Boy, would it be fun to explain that to a courtroom, I said. I shuddered. Or to the White Council, for that matter. If I take out the wrong person, I could wind up in jail, or in a White Council Star Chamber trial. Mavra's using the laws to protect herself against us. That's so backward.
Screw the laws. Kill 'em all, Bob said with weary cheer.
I sighed. What about the dogs?
Your basic animal, Bob said. But they've been infused with a portion of the same kind of dark power that the Black Court runs on. They're stronger, faster, and they don't feel pain. I once saw a darkhound rip its way through a brick wall.
I bet they look like normal dogs afterward, huh?
And beforeward, Bob said.
I guess if the cops are on my case when this is over, the SPCA can come along for the ride. I shook my head.
And on top of all that, Mavra is also keeping those hostages in the closet for food. She'll use them as human shields once fighting starts.
Or as bait in a trap, Bob said.
Yeah. Either way, it makes things more complicated. Even if we go in when Mavra and her scourge are sleeping.
I looked at Bob's diagram of the lair.
Any security system?
Old electronic one, Bob said. Nothing fancy. No problem for you to hex it down.
Mavra will know that. She'll have sentries. We need to get past them.
Forget it. Rough thralls and Renfields don't exactly make the most observant guardians in the world, but the Darkhounds make up for them. If you want to sneak up, you'll have to be invisible, inaudible, and unsmellable. Don't count on a surprise attack.
Damn it. What kind of weapons are they toting?
Teeth. Mostly teeth, Harry.
I glared at him.
Not the dogs.
Oh. The thralls have got some baseball bats. The Renfields have assault rifles, grenades, and body armor.
Holy crap.
Bob leered at me from his shelf.
Oh, ism scared of the mean old machine guns?
I glowered and flipped a pencil at the skull. Maybe Murphy can figure out a way to do this without starting World War III. Meanwhile, change of topic incoming. I need your opinion.
Sure, Bob said. Hit me.
I told him about the entropy curse and who I thought was behind it.
Ritual magic, Bob confirmed. More amateurs.
Who sponsors ritual curses these days? I asked. Well, in theory, a lot of powers. In practice, though, the writings on most of them have been gathered up by the Council, or the Venatori, or someone else with some supernatural clout. Or else destroyed. It might take me some time to recall all the details. Why? I asked. Because I've got about 600 years worth of memories to sort through, and I'm exhausted, Bob said, his voice softer, as though coming from far away. But you can be pretty sure that whoever is backing a death curse isn't real friendly.
Tell me something I don't know, I said. Hey, Bob.
Hmm?
Is it possible to work some kind of spell that would last, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 years?
Sure, if you spend enough money, Bob said. Or if you're some kind of sentimental family sap.
Sentimental? How's that?
Well, you can anchor magic to certain materials, right? Most of them are very expensive. Or you do the cheap kind, like you use on your blasting rod and such, refresh them once in a while.
The skull's eyes were growing rapidly dimmer.
But there are times when you can anchor it to a person.
That isn't doable, I said.
Not for you, Bob said. Gotta be a blood relation, blood in common, that kind of thing. Maybe if you had a kid, but I guess you'd need a girlfriend for that, huh?
I raked my hand through my hair, thinking. And if you do it that way, the spell lasts, even for that long?
Oh, sure, Bob said. As long as the person you anchor it to is alive. Takes a tiny bit of energy off them to keep the spell from slowing down. That's why all the really nasty curses you hear about usually involve some family somewhere.
So, for instance, I said, my mother could have laid out a curse on someone. And as long as I was alive, it would still be viable.
Exactly. Or like that Loop Guru guy. His own bloodline keeps the curse fueled.
The skull's mouth opened in a yawn.
Anything else?
I picked up the map and tucked it into a pocket. Bob was at the end of his resources, and I had no time to lose. I'd have to finish out this one on my own. Get some rest and see what you can remember, I said. I've got to clear out before the cops get here. I started to get up off my stool, and every muscle in my body complained to be moving again. I winced and said, painkillers. Definitely need painkillers, too.
Luck, Harry,
Bob mumbled, and the glittering orange lights in the skull's eye sockets dimmed completely. My body ached as I climbed back out of the lab. It was getting to be pretty good at aching, actually, by virtue of all the practice. I could ignore pain. I had a talent for ignoring it. That talent had been refined by the harsh lessons of life, and the even harsher lessons of Justin de Morne. But even so, the discomfort took its toll. My bed wasn't particularly luxurious, but it looked that way when I passed it on my way to the door. I had my keys in my hand and my bag over one shoulder when there was a rattling from the dim corner by the door. I paused, and a moment later, my wizard's staff twitched, rattling again. It shuddered and twitched, thumping against the wall and the floor in staccato fits, too much rhythm to the sounds for them to be meaningless. Well, I muttered, it's about damn time. I picked up my staff, wrapped one end hard on the floor, and focused my attention on the length of wood. I reached down through it, into the steady, heavy power of the earth beneath it, and then beat out my own short rhythm on the stone. My staff went still, then quivered sharply twice in my hand. I set out water and food for Mister, left, and locked my apartment behind me, then sealed the wards of protective energy around it. By the time I was up the stairs, a heavy old Ford truck, a battered and tough-looking survivor of the Great Depression, pulled into the gravel parking lot at the side of the boarding house and crunched to a halt. It had Missouri plates. A gun rack at the back of the cab held an old double-barreled shotgun in its top slot, and a thick, stumpy old wizard staff in the one beneath it. The driver set the brake and swung open the door without letting the engine die. He was old but hale, a short, stocky man in overalls, heavy working boots, and a flannel shirt. He had broad hands with scarred knuckles and wore a plain steel ring on each index finger. A few white hairs drifted around his sun-toughened scalp.
He had dark eyes, a severely annoyed expression, and he snorted upon seeing me.
"Hey there, Hoss. You look like 10 miles of bet. Clichés," I interjected, smiling.
The old man puffed out a breath of quiet laughter and offered me his hand. I shook it and found myself newly appreciative of the calloused strength that belied the man's evident age.
"Good to see you, sir. I was starting to feel a little swamped."
Ebenezer McCoy, senior member of the White Council, a sometime mentor of mine, and by all accounts I'd heard, one hell of a strong wizard, clapped me on my biceps with its free hand.
"You in over your head? It's as if you're too stubborn to know when to run."
"We'd best get moving," I told him. "The police will be along shortly." His frown knitted his shaggy white eyebrows together, but he nodded and said,
"Hop in."
I got in the truck and slid my staff into the gun rack with Ebenezer's. The old man's staff was shorter and thicker than mine, but the carved sigils and formulae on it were noticeably similar, and the texture and color of the wood was identical. They'd both come from the same lightning-wounded tree back on Ebenezer's land in the Ozarks. I shut the door and closed my eyes for a moment while Ebenezer got the truck rolling.
"Your moss is rusty," he said a few minutes later. "On my staff, it sounded like he spelled it blampires."
"I did," I said. "Black court vampires. I just shortened it some." Ebenezer tisked.
"Blampires. That's the problem with you young people, shortening all the words."
"Too many acronyms?" I asked.
"I am."
"Well then," I said, "I'm glad you took the time to RSVP me. I have a problem that needs to stay on the QT, but is rapidly going foobar. I'm sorry to call you LD through AT&T instead of using UPS, but I needed your help ASAP. I hope that's okay."
Ebenezer grunted, shot me a sidelong look, and said, "Don't make me kick your ass."
"No, sir," I said.
"Black court," he said.
"Who?"
"Mavra. You know her?"
"I know it," he said, the pronoun mildly emphasized.
"Killed a friend of mine in the Venatori once, and she was in the warden's files. They suspect she's got a little skill at dark sorcery and consider her to be very dangerous."
"It's more than a little skill," I said. The old man frowned.
"Oh?"
"Yeah. I've seen her throw raw power around and put up the best veil I'd ever seen through. I also saw her using some long-range mental communications with her flunkies."
The old man frowned. "That's more than a little."
"Uh-huh. She's gunning for me. Only, you know, without the guns." Ebenezer frowned, but nodded.
"She's holding that mess at the Velvet Room against you?"
"That's how it looks from here," I said. "She's taken 2 swings at me, but I found where she's layered, and I want to take her down before she gets to 3.
"Makes sense," he said. "What's your plan?"
"I've got help. Murphy,
the police girl?"
he interrupted.
"God, don't call her a girl," I said.
"At least not to her face."
"Yeah, her and a mercenary named Kincaid."
"Haven't heard of him," Ebenezer said.
"He works for the Archive," I said, "and he's good at killing vampires. I'm going in with those two, but we need someone standing by to get us out in a hurry."
"I'm your driver, eh?" he mused.
"And I suppose you want someone to lock down Marbra's power, if she's got access to that much magic."
"It hadn't occurred to me, really," I lied. "But hey, if you're bored and want to do that to pass the time while you keep the car running, I don't mind."
The old man's teeth flashed in a wolfish smile. "I'll keep that in mind, Hoss."
"I don't have anything to use as a channel, though," I said. "Are you going to be able to target her without hair or blood or something?"
"Yes," Ebenezer said. He didn't elaborate how he'd do it. "Though I doubt I can get her down to nothing. I can prevent her from working anything big, but she might have enough left in her to be annoying."
"I'll take what I can get," I said. "But we need to move, right now. She's already taken several people."
"Vampires are that way," Ebenezer agreed in a casual tone, but I saw the way his eyes narrowed. He didn't care for monsters like Mavra any more than I did. I could have kissed him.
"Thank you," he shook his head.
"What about her death curse?"
I blinked.
"You'd thought of that, right?"
he asked.
"What death curse?" I stammered.
Use your head, boy, Ebenezer said. If she's got a wizard's power, she might well be able to level a death curse at you when she goes down.
Oh, come on, I muttered. That's no fair. She's already dead.
Hadn't thought of that, huh? He asked.
No, I said. Though I should have. Been a busy couple of days, what with dodging all the certain death coming at me from every direction. Not a second to spare for thinking. We have precious little time. He grunted.
So, where are we going?
I checked the time at a passing bank billboard.
A picnic. Chapter 28.
What looked like a small army had invaded a portion of Wolf Lake Park and claimed it in the name of God and Clan Murphy. Cars filled a little parking lot nearby and lined the nearest lane for 100 yards in either direction. Summer had been generous with the rain for once, and all the trees in the park had put on glorious autumn colors, so bright that if I scrunched up my eyes until my lashes blurred my vision, they almost seemed to be afire. In the park, a couple of gazebos had been stockpiled with tables and lots of food, and a pair of portable pavilions flanked them, giving shade to maybe a dozen people who had fired up their grills and were singeing meat. Music was playing from several different locations, the beats of the various songs stumbling into one another, and evidently someone had brought a generator, because there was an enormous TV set up out in the grass, while a dozen men crowded around it, talking loudly, laughing, and arguing about what looked to be a college football game. There were also a pair of volleyball nets and a badminton net, and enough frisbees flying around to foul up radar at the local airports. A giant inflatable castle wobbled dramatically as a dozen children bounced around on the inside of it, caroming off the walls and one another with equal amounts of enthusiasm. More kids ran in packs all over the place, and there must have been a dozen dogs gleefully racing one another and begging food from anyone who seemed to have some. The air smelled like charcoal, mesquite, and insect repellent, and buzzed with happy chatter. I stood there for a minute, watching the festivities. Spotting Murphy in a crowd of a couple of 100 people wasn't easy. I tried to be methodical, sweeping the area with my gaze from left to right. I didn't spot Murphy, but as I stood there, it occurred to me that a bruised and battered man, better than 6.5 feet tall, in a black leather duster, didn't exactly blend in with the crowd at the Murphy picnic. A couple of the men around the television had spotted me with the kind of attention that made me think that they were with the law. Another man walking by with a white styrofoam cooler on one shoulder noticed the men at the television and followed their gaze to me. He was in his mid-30s and about an inch or two over average height. His brown hair was cut short, as was a neatly cropped goatee. He had the kind of build that dangerous men seem to develop, not enormous, pretty muscle, but the kind of lean sinew that indicated speed and endurance as well as strength. And he was a cop. Don't ask me how I could tell. It was just something about the way he held himself, the way he kept track of his surroundings. He promptly changed course, walked up to me, and said, "Hey there."
"Hey," I said.
His tone was overtly friendly, but I could taste the suspicion in it. "Mind if I ask what you're doing here?"
I didn't have time for this crap.
"Yes." He dropped the fake friendliness. "Listen, buddy, this is a family get-together. Maybe you could find another part of the park to stand around looking foreboding."
"Free country," I said. "Public park."
"Which has been reserved by the Murphy family for the day," he said. "Look, buddy, you're scaring the kids. Walk."
"Or you'll call the cops?" I asked.
He set the cooler down and squared off facing me, just barely far enough away to avoid a sucker punch. He looked relaxed, too. He knew what he was doing.
"I'll do you a favor and call the ambulance first."
By this time, we were getting more attention from the football fans. I was frustrated enough to be tempted to push him a little bit more, but there was no sense in it. I assumed that the cops and the family were off today, but if I got beaten up, someone might call in and find out about Emma's death. That was a good way to get bogged down in the holding cell and dead. The guy faced me with confidence, even though I had a head and shoulders on him and outweighed him by 40 or 50 pounds. He knew if anything happened, he'd have a ton of help. Must be a nice feeling. I lifted a hand by way of capitulation. I'll go. I just need to speak to Karen Murphy for a moment. Business. His expression flickered with surprise that was quickly hidden. Oh. He looked around. Over there, he said. She's reffing the soccer game. Thanks. Sure, the man said. You know, it wouldn't kill you to be a little more polite. Why take chances? I muttered, turning my back on him and heading over to the makeshift soccer field. There were a bunch of rugrats too big for playground equipment and too young for pimples, playing with what could kindly be construed as abundant enthusiasm, while a few motherly types looked on. But I didn't see Murphy. I began to turn around and start another sweep. At this rate, I would have to ask someone for directions. Harry? Murphy's voice called from behind me. I turned around. My jaw dropped open. I was lucky none of the kids kicked their soccer ball into my exposed uvula. It took me a minute to stammer, "You're wearing a dress." She glowered up at me. Murphy wasn't going to qualify under anyone's definition of willowy or svelte, but she had the build of a gymnast, tough, flexible, and strong. Generally speaking, being 5'0", 100-0, and female had made her professional life less than pleasant, including getting her landed in charge of special investigations, a post that was the career equivalent to being exiled to the Bastille, or maybe left out for the ants. Murphy had excelled at her new job, much to the distress of the folks who had gotten her put there, partly, to be sure, because she had engaged the services of the only professional wizard in Chicago, but also because she was damned good at her job. She had been able to inspire loyalty, to judge and employ her detective's skills effectively, and to keep everyone together through some fairly terrifying times, both in my company and outside of it. She was smart, tough, dedicated, and everything else an ideal leader of a police division should be. Except male, in a profession that was still very much a boys' club. As a result, Murphy had made a number of accommodations to the male ego. She was an award-winning marksman. She had taken more than her share of martial arts tournaments, and she continued to train ferociously, most of it with, among, and around cops. There was no one in the department who had any questions about whether or not Murphy could introduce the baddest bad guys to new vistas of physical pain in hand-to-hand. And no one who had survived the battle with the Lugaroo would ever doubt her skill with firearms or her courage again. But being Murphy, she went the extra mile. She wore her hair shorter than she liked it, and she went almost entirely without makeup or adornments. She dressed functionally, never scruffy, mind you, but almost always very subdued and practical, and never, ever wore a dress. This one was long, full, and yellow, and it had flowers. It looked quite lovely and utterly wrong. Just wrong. Murphy in a dress. My world felt askew. "I hate these things," she complained. She looked down, brushing at the skirt, and swished it back and forth a little. "I always did." "Wow. Why are you wearing it, then?" "My mom made it for me," Murphy sighed. "So I thought, you know, maybe it would make her happy to see me in it." She took a whistle from around her neck, promoted one of the kids to referee, and started walking. I fell into pace beside her. "You found them," she said. "Yeah. Our driver is here, and I called Kincaid about 20 minutes ago. He'll have the hardware nearby and waiting for us." I took a deep breath. "And we need to move in a hurry." "Why?" she asked. "I'm pretty sure your brothers and sisters in law enforcement are going to want to sit me down for a long talk. I'd rather they didn't until I'd closed a couple of accounts." I gave her a brief rundown of Emma's murder. "Christ," she said. After a few steps, she added, "At least this time around I heard it from you first. I've got a change of clothes in the car. What else do I need to know?" "Tell you on the way," I said. "Right," she said. "Look, I promised my mom I'd come see her before I left. My sister wanted to talk to me about something. 2 minutes." "Sure," I said, and we veered toward one of the pavilions. "You have a big family. How many?" "Couple of hundred the last time I looked," she said. "There, in the white blouse, that's mother."
The girl in the tight everything is my baby sister, Lisa.
Baby sister has pretty legs, I noted, but those shorts must be a little binding.
The clothes keep the blood from reaching her brain, Murphy said. At least that's my theory.
She stepped under the pavilion, smiling, and said, Hi, Mom.
Murphy's mom was taller than her daughter, but she had that kind of matronly plumpness that comes with age, pasta, and a comfortable life. Her hair was dark blonde, threaded through with gray that she had made no effort at all to conceal, and it was held back off her face with a jade comb. She was wearing a white blouse, a floral print skirt, and tinted sunglasses. She turned around to face Murphy as we walked up, and her face lit for a moment.
Karen, she said, her tone warm and wary.
Murphy held out her hands as she walked over to her mom, and the two clasped hands and hugged. There was a sort of stiffness to the gesture that suggested ritual formality and less than pleasant emotional undercurrents. They batted a few chatty words back and forth, and while they did, I noted something odd. There had been at least a dozen people under the pavilion when we came in, but most of them had wandered away. In fact, there was a widening circle of open space clearing out around the pavilion. Murphy didn't miss it either. She glanced back at me, and I quirked an eyebrow at her. She twitched one shoulder in a minimal shrug and went back to talking with her mom. A minute later, only 5 people were within 20 or 30 feet. Me, Murphy, her mom, little sister Lisa, and the man whose lap she was draped across, the guy with the cooler. They were behind Murphy and me, and I turned my body halfway so that I could look at them without totally ignoring Murphy and her mom. Lisa reminded me a lot of Murphy, had Murphy been an estrogen princess rather than a warrior princess. Blonde hair, fair skin, a pert nose, and cornflower blue eyes. She wore a scarlet baby doll t-shirt with the Chicago Bulls team logo stretched out over her chest. Her shorts had been blue jeans at some point, but they had come down with a bad case of spandex envy. She wore flip-flops and dangled them from her painted toes as she sat across the lap of the man I presumed to be the fiancé Murphy had mentioned. He made quite a contrast with Lisa. He was a bit older than her, for one. Not double her age or anything, but definitely older. He was being careful not to let any expression show on his face, and it made me think that he was worried about something. Mom, Murphy was saying, this is my friend, Harry. Harry, this is my mother, Marion. I put on my best smile for Mother Murphy and stepped forward, offering her my hand. Charmed, ma'am. She shook my hand and gave me a calculating look. Her grip reminded me of Murphy's. Her hands were small, strong, and had been hardened by work. Thank you, Harry. And this is my baby sister, Lisa, Murphy said, turning to face her for the first time. Lisa, this is... Murphy froze, her words dying into a choking gasp. Rich, she said after a second, her voice shaking with a tide of emotion. What are you doing here? He murmured something to Lisa. The girl slipped off his lap and he stood slowly up. Hello, Karen. You're looking well.
You miserable son of a bitch, Murphy spat. What do you think you're doing?
Karen, Murphy's mom snapped, there is no place for that kind of language here.
Oh, please, Lisa cried.
I don't have to put up with that, Karen, Rich growled. Murphy clenched her hands into fists.
Whoa, whoa, people, I said. I must have been feeling suicidal because I took a step forward and placed myself in the middle of the circle of angry stares.
Come on, guys. At least let me get introduced to everyone before the fighting starts, so I'll know who to duck.
There was a second of heavy silence, and then Rich snorted out a quiet laugh and subsided back into his chair. Lisa folded her arms. Murphy tensed up a little, but with her, it was a good sign. She always got that deadly relaxed look to her stance when she was about to kick someone's ass.
Thank you, Harry, Mama Murphy said in a loud tone. She stepped forward with a paper plate laden with a hamburger and passed it to me.
It's nice to know there's another adult present. Why don't we get everyone introduced, Karen? I checked the burger. It had everything on it but cheese, just the way I liked it. I was favorably impressed with Mama Murphy. And I was starving, too. More bonus points. Murphy stepped up beside me. Right. Introductions. Harry, this is my baby sister, Lisa. She glared daggers at the man. And this is Rich, my second husband.
Oh, dear Lord. Murphy stared from her mom to her sister to Rich.
I know we haven't talked in a while, Mother, so let's get caught up. Why don't we start with why Lisa is engaged to my ex-husband, and none of you even bothered to tell me?
Lisa lifted her chin.
It isn't my fault if you're too much of a bitch to get a man to stay with you. Rich wanted an actual woman, which is why you aren't involved with him anymore. And I didn't tell you, because it was none of your damn business.
Lisa, scolded Mama Murphy.
That is not the kind of language a lady uses. And those aren't the kind of clothes a lady wears, Murphy said, her voice tart. She might as well talk like a whore, too.
Karen, Mama Murphy protested, her voice shocked. There wasn't time for this either. I stepped up next to Murphy and gave Rich a half-desperate look.
Okay, Rich said. He stood up from his chair, slipping an arm around Lisa's shoulders. This is no good. Come on, baby. Time for a walk until you cool off. Let's go find a beer.
Murph, I said. I leaned down enough to mutter at her ear. Remember? No time.
Murphy folded her arms, her expression unrepentant, but at least she turned away from her sister. Rich and Murphy Spice walked off toward the other pavilion. Mother Murphy waited until they were gone before she faced us, her frown speaking volumes of disapproval.
For goodness sake, Karen, you aren't children anymore.
Explosion averted, at least for the moment. I seized the opportunity to eat the hamburger.
Oh, my God. For food this good, I'd marry Murphy just for her mom's cooking on holidays.
I can't believe it, Murphy said. Rich! I thought he was working in New Orleans.
He is, Mama Murphy said. Lisa went down for Mardi Gras. Apparently he had to arrest her.
Mother, Murphy protested, you let her go to Mardi Gras? I had to sneak out of the house to go to the prom.
Mother Murphy sighed. Karen, you're the oldest child. She's the youngest. All parents get a little more relaxed along the way.
Apparently, Murphy said, her voice bitter, that includes tolerating felonies like providing alcohol to a minor. She's underage for beer until next month.
It's always about work, isn't it? Mama Murphy said. This has nothing to do with work, Murphy shot back. Mother, he's twice her age. How could you?
I partook of near-divine hamburger and kept my head down, and felt wise for doing so.
In the first place, dear, it isn't up to me. It's your sister's life, and he isn't twice her age. Worse things have happened. She sighed. We all felt Lisa should be the one to talk to you, but you know how she hates confronting you.
She's a gutless little harlot, you mean?
That will be enough, young lady,
Mama Murphy said, her voice crackling with heat and steel.
Your sister found a man who genuinely loves her. I might not be entirely confident about the notion, but she's old enough to make her own choices. And besides, you know how much I always liked Rich.
Yes, I know, Murphy growled. Can we talk about something else?
All right. Where are the boys?
Mama Murphy rolled her eyes and nodded at the group around the big television out on the grass.
Somewhere in there. You can hear them yelling if you listen.
Murphy snorted.
I'm surprised Rich isn't watching the game, too.
Karen, I know you're still angry with him, but it's hardly the man's fault that he wanted to start a family.
That was just a rationalization, Mother, Murphy said. What he wanted was for me to stay home so that I wouldn't make him look bad at work.
I'm sorry you still think that, Mama Murphy replied, but you're cheapening him. It isn't as though he could start a family by himself. He wanted a woman willing to do that with him.
You made it clear that you didn't.
Because I didn't want to give up what I do.
There are other people in the family who have taken up your father's duties, Mother Murphy said, her voice bitter. There's no need for you to do it. That isn't why I became a cop. Mother Murphy shook her head and sighed.
Karen, your brothers are all serving. They're taking their time and settling down. I don't want to tell you what to do with your life,
Murphy snorted.
But I do want to have the chance to hold my grandchildren while I'm still young enough and strong enough to do it. Rich wants to settle down, and your sister wants to be the woman he does it with. Is that such a bad thing?
I just can't see you flying to New Orleans every month to visit them.
Of course not, dear, Mama Murphy replied. I don't have that kind of money. That's why they'll be settling down here.
Murphy's mouth dropped open.
Rich has already put in for his transfer and had it approved. He'll be working for the FBI office here in Illinois.
I don't believe this, Murphy grated. My own sister, here, with Rich.
And you're just going to keep throwing this in my face.
Not everything is about you, Karen, her mother said, her voice prim. I'm sure we can all be adults about this.
But he's my ex-husband.
Whom you divorced, Murphy's mother replied. But the harsh words were delivered in a gentle tone.
For goodness sake, Karen, you've already made it clear that you didn't want him. Why should you care if someone else does?
I don't, Murphy protested. She waved a vague hand.
But Lisa isn't just someone.
Ah, said Mama Murphy. Just then, Murphy's cell phone chirped. She checked it, frowned, and said,
Excuse me.
Then she walked 20 or 30 feet away from me, out into the sunshine, head bent to the phone.
That will be work, I assume, Mama Murphy said to me. You're the private investigator, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
I saw you on Larry Fowler,
I sighed.
Yeah. Is it true that he's suing you for demolishing his studio?
Yeah, and his car. I had to get a lawyer and everything. The lawyer says that Fowler's guy won't have a case, even in civil court, but it's expensive and it's taking forever.
The legal system can be that way, Mama Murphy agreed. I'm sorry my daughter dragged you into our family squabble.
I volunteered, I said.
And now you regret it?
I shook my head.
Heck no. She's been there for me too many times, Mrs. Murphy.
I don't know if you're aware of how dangerous her job can be. The kinds of things she faces in special investigations can be especially difficult and disturbing. Your daughter saves lives. There are people who would be dead right now if she hadn't been there. I'm several of them.
Mama Murphy was quiet for a moment before she said,
Before they established special investigations, the department routinely handed all those cases to senior detectives in the 13th precinct. The cases were referred to as black cat investigations, the detectives as black cats.
I didn't know that, I said.
She nodded. My husband was a black cat for 12 years.
I frowned. Murphy never told me that.
I never told her. And Karen never knew her father very well, Mama Murphy said. He was away so much of the time, and he died when she was only 11.
Line of duty? Mama Murphy shook her head.
The work got to him. He grew distant and started to drink too much. And one night at his desk, he took his own life.
She faced me and said, her voice tired and sad,
You see, Harry, my Colin never spoke of it, but I can read between lines as well as anyone. I know what my daughter is facing.
That hung in the air between us for a moment.
She's good, I said.
Not just skilled. She's got a good heart, Mrs. Murphy. I'd sooner trust her with my life than anyone else in the world.
It isn't fair for you to give her a hard time about her job.
Mama Murphy's eyes sparkled, though they were also a little sad.
She thinks she's protecting me from the awful truth, Harry, when I complain about her work and she keeps things secret in reply. It makes her happy to know that her mother is not even aware of such dangerous things. I could never take that away from her. I arched an eyebrow at Mama Murphy, then smiled. What? She asked. I see where she gets it, I said. Murphy turned back to me, her expression hard, and beckoned me. I went over to her. It's Kincaid, she said, her voice held tight and quiet. He says to tell you he's at the shelter, and the Red Cross has shown up.
What? Hell's bells.
She nodded. They do a blood drive every 3 months out of the shelter's basement. Where the Black Court was, where the coffins and Renfields and Dark Hounds were, Mavra and her brood would never allow themselves to be seen. The Red Cross volunteers were as good as dead if they went in the basement.
Oh, crap.
I'm calling it in, she said. No, I said, alarmed. You can't do that. Like hell I can't, she said. People are in danger. And they're going to be in more danger if this escalates, I said. Tell Kincaid to try to delay the Red Cross people. We'll get down there and hit Mavra right now, before the volunteers can put themselves in the line of fire. Murphy scowled up at me, her voice rising a little. People started to give us surreptitious looks. Don't tell me how to do my job. This isn't your job, Murph, I said. Do you remember when I told you that I'd tell you everything? Do you remember that you agreed to trust my judgment? That you wouldn't go calling in the cavalry on these things? Her expression became even more furious. Do you think that I'm too stupid to know how to handle this? I think that you're way too worked up already, and that you can't let this family thing get in the way of making the right decision. Getting the mortal authorities involved would be bad for everyone, Murph. Bad for you, bad for SI. You might win the day, but when these things hit back, your people are going to suffer. For a second, I thought she was going to strangle me. What do you expect me to do? I got in her face, and I didn't care if she avoided my eyes or not. I expect you to listen to the person who knows what he's talking about. I expect you to trust me, Murph, the way I trusted you. Get on the damn phone and tell Kincaid what I said and ask where to meet him. Then we take care of business. The eye contact got more intense, but Murphy shivered and broke it off before it could go any deeper. Fine, she said. I'll do it. But don't think I won't kick your ass over this later. Now back off before you blow up my phone. I did, returning to the pavilion. Mama Murphy regarded me speculatively. Work? I nodded. That was quite an argument, she said. I shrugged. It would seem that you won it. I sighed and said wryly, and I'll pay for it later. You'll both be leaving, then?
Yeah.
Mama Murphy looked back and forth between me and Murphy for a moment and then said, Let me get you another burger before you go. I blinked at her. She assembled food, including a second burger for Murphy, and passed me the paper plates. She frowned at my hands, then up at my face, and asked, Will you take care of my daughter?
Yes, ma'am. Of course I will.
Her blue eyes flashed fiercely, and she said, Let me get you a piece of cake. Chapter 29. Murphy grabbed a gym bag out of her car and then followed me to Ebenezer's truck. She stopped about 20 feet short of it and said, You're kidding me. Come on, I said. You want to show up where there might be some trouble in your own car? That'd be nice for the responding emergency units to see. So get in. What does it run on, coal? Ebenezer stuck his bald head out of the window, scowling.
No idea. Mostly I just turn it loose to hunt down dinner for itself.
Murph, I said, this is Ebenezer McCoy. Ebenezer, this is Karen Murphy.
You, Ebenezer said, without approval. I heard you've given the boy a hard time.
Murphy scowled. Who the hell are you?
My teacher, I told her in a quieter voice. A friend.
She glanced at me, then pursed her lips. She didn't miss the shotgun or the staff in the truck. You're coming along to help?
As long as you don't think I'm too old, girlie, he drawled, heavy on the sarcasm. You got a driver's license? You driven Chicago streets lately? The old wizard scowled at her. Thought so, she said. Move over. He sputtered.
What?
I'm driving, she said. So move. I sighed. Better move over, sir, I told Ebenezer. We're in a hurry. Murphy's gym bag thumped onto the ground, and she stared at me with her mouth open. What? I asked.
Sir?
She said, her voice incredulous. I scowled at her and ducked my head. She picked up her bag, blinked a couple of times, and said in her professionally politest tones, If you don't mind, Mr. McCoy, I know the streets better, and there are lives at stake. Ebenezer's scowl had been half subverted by a small smile, but he said, Bah, I'm too old to see the street signs anyway. He opened the door and started scooting. Get in, get in. Come on, Hoss, we ain't got time to wait on you. Murphy did not go so far as to slap her magnetic cop light on the top of the truck, but she got us to a parking garage near Mauver's lair in a big hurry. She knew the streets of the old town as well as anyone I'd ever seen, and she regarded niceties like red lights, one-way streets, and right-of-way with an almost magnificent lack of concern. Ebenezer's old truck kept up with her gamely enough, though I found my head bouncing off the roof a couple of times. I told Murphy what I'd learned about the vampire's lair on the way. Murphy shook her head. Damn, this isn't what I expected, that they take something right in the middle of so many people. Me either, I said. But that only means we need to move sooner instead of later. The longer the vamps are there, the more of those hostages they're going to bleed out, and the greater the risk of one of their Renfields snapping and opening up on pedestrians with an assault rifle. Assault rifles, Murphy said. And hostages. Jesus, Harry, people could die. No could about it. They're already dying, I replied. At least 3 bodies already, and the Renfields are just a matter of time. What if you're wrong? Murphy said. Do you really expect me to charge in, guns blazing, against people who might or might not already be dead? I have an obligation to protect citizens, not to sacrifice them. My teeth clacked together as the truck went over a heavy bump. These are the Black Court. They kill, and they do it frequently. Not only that, but they can propagate their kind more rapidly than any other vampire. If we let a nest of them go unmolested, we could potentially have dozens of them in a few days. In 2 weeks, there could be hundreds. Something has to be done, and now. Murphy shook her head. But it doesn't mean it needs to be vigilante work. Harry, give me 3 hours to establish probable cause, and I'll have every cop and every SWAT team in 200 miles ready to take on that nest. And you'll tell them what, exactly, I said. Basement full of vampires is not going to cut it, and you know it. And if they go in with blinders on, cops will get killed. And if it's us? Murphy asked. What then? We kick down the door, shoot anything standing, and then make like we're the flying Van Helsings? A direct assault on a wary target is one of the best ways in the world to get killed. So we figure something out, I said. We get a plan. Murphy shot me a look past Ebenezer, who evidently had decided to stay out of it. This isn't like the Walmart plan with the marbles, is it? I'll tell you when I know. Let's get there and see if we can find out first. Maybe Kincaid will have something. Yeah, Murphy said without much hope. Maybe. Here, this is where Kincaid is meeting us. It wasn't a pleasant neighborhood. The city had been working on urban renewal projects for decades, but the lion's share of the money had gone to restore higher-profile, more infamous neighborhoods, such as Cabrini Green. In that time, many neighborhoods that had been borderline steadily eroded and had usurped the infamous neighborhood crown. The slum is dead. Long live the slum. I'd seen worse, but not many. Tall buildings and narrow alleys choked out a lot of the sunshine. Most windows below the 3rd or 4th floor had been boarded up. Ground-level commercial properties were largely vacant. The storm drains were clogged with litter and other urban detritus. Most of the streetlights were out, and graffiti and gang signs had been spray-painted everywhere. The air smelled like mildew, garbage, and exhaust. The residents of the neighborhood moved with brisk purpose, confidence, and flat eyes as they walked, doing everything they could to indicate by body language that they were not good targets for assault or robbery.
I spotted a drug house in the first 10 seconds of looking around. The burned-out hulk of an abandoned car had been stripped for parts before it had been set on fire, and I had a notion that Murphy was the first cop to visit in the past several weeks. But there was something missing. Bums. Transients. Homeless folk. Winos. Bag ladies. Even in broad daylight, there should have been someone collecting cans, panhandling change, or shambling along drinking from a bottle still covered with a paper bag. But there wasn't. Everyone moving was getting from one place to another, not eking out a living from the environment. "Look kind of quiet to you here?" Murphy asked, voice tight. "Yeah," I said. "They've been killing," she said, almost spitting the words.
"Maybe. Maybe not," Ebenezer said.
I nodded. "There's dark power at work here. People sense that, even if they don't know what it is. You're feeling it now." "What do you mean?" I shrugged. "The presence of dark magic. It makes you feel nervous and angry. If you forced yourself to calm down and tried to sense it, you could feel it. It leaves a kind of stain around it."
"Stinks," rumbled Ebenezer.
"What does that have to do with missing street people?" Murphy asked. "You've been here about 3 minutes, and the power bothers you already. Imagine living in it, getting a little more afraid every day, angrier, more demoralized. People get rattled enough to leave, even if they don't understand why. Over the long term, this kind of power breeds its own wasteland."
"You mean that the vampires have been here for a while?" she asked.
"To have this much effect, it's been days at least," I said, nodding.
"More like 2 weeks," Ebenezer grunted with assurance. "Maybe 3.
"God," Murphy said, shivering. "That's scary."
"Yeah. If they've been here that long, it means Mavra has something in mind." She frowned.
"You mean that this vampire came here and then chose when to make you aware of its presence? This could be a trap."
"It's possible. Paranoid, but possible." Her mouth tightened into a line.
"You didn't mention that at breakfast."
"We're doing battle with the living dead, Murph. Expect the occasional curveball."
"Are you patronizing me now?"
I shook my head.
"No. Honest. Where's Kincaid?"
"Second level of this parking garage," Murphy said. "Stop on the first level," I told her.
"Why?"
"He doesn't know about Ebenezer, and I don't want to spook him. We'll walk up and meet him." Ebenezer nodded to us and said,
"Good call, Hoss. Decent gunman could be twitchy. I'll give you a minute, then drive on up."
Murphy stopped the truck and we got out. I waited until we were several paces from the truck before I lowered my voice and said,
"I know. You're afraid."
She glared at me and started to deny it, but she knew better and shrugged one shoulder instead.
"Some.
So am I. It's okay."
"I thought I was over this," she said.
Her jaw tightened.
"I mean, the night terrors are gone. I can sleep again, but it isn't like before, Harry. I used to get scared, but I'd be excited, too. I would have wanted to do it. But I don't want this. I'm so afraid that I'm about to throw up, which sucks."
"You're scared because you've learned things," I told her. "You know the kinds of things you're fighting," I said. "You know what could happen. You'd be an idiot if you weren't afraid. I wouldn't want someone with me who didn't have enough sense to be worried." She nodded, but asked,
"What if I freeze up on you again?"
"You won't."
"It could happen."
"It won't," I said.
"You sure?"
I winked at her and twirled my staff in one hand. "I wouldn't be betting my life on it otherwise. You've got my back, Murph. Shut up and dance." She nodded, her expression remote.
"There's nothing we can do to stop these things."
The "we" had changed. She meant the police. "No, not without getting a lot of good cops killed."
"Those people with the vampires, these Renfields. We'll have to kill some of them, won't we?"
"Probably," I said in a quiet voice.
"It isn't their fault they were taken."
"I know. We'll do whatever we can to avoid killing them. But from what I know about them, they're too far gone to leave us many options."
"Do you remember Agent Wilson?" Murphy asked.
"The Fed you shot off my back?"
Murph's expression flickered,
though it wasn't quite a flinch.
Yeah. He went outside the law to bring down the people he thought were beyond its reach. And now, we're making that same choice.
No, we aren't, I said.
No? Why not?
Because they aren't people. Murphy frowned. I thought about it.
Even if they were, assuming they were still as dangerous and untouchable, would it change anything?
I don't know, she said. That's what scares me.
For as long as I'd known her, Murphy had upheld the law. She had a good head on her shoulders when it came to the nature of good and evil and of right and wrong, but her first duty had been to the law. She believed in it, that it was the best way to help and protect her fellow man. She'd had faith that the power of the law, while imperfect, was absolute, almost holy. It was a rallying point in her soul, a foundation block of her strength. But several years of staring out of the darkness had showed her that the law was both blind and deaf to some of the nastier parts of the world. She'd seen things that moved in the shadows, perverting the purpose of the law to use it as a weapon against the people she had sworn to defend. Her faith had taken a beating, or she wouldn't even have considered stepping outside the boundaries of her authority, and she knew it. That knowledge cost her dearly. There weren't any tears in her eyes, but I knew that they were there, on the inside, while she mourned the death of her faith.
I don't know the right thing to do, she said.
Neither do I said. But someone has to do something, and we're the only ones around. Either we choose to take a stand now, or we choose to stand around at all the funerals, regretting it later.
Yeah, Murphy said. She took a deep, almost meditative breath. I guess I needed to hear that said out loud.
A small but violent light flared to life behind her eyes.
Let's go. I'm ready.
Murph, I said. She tilted her head and looked at me. My lips suddenly felt very dry.
You look good in the dress.
Her eyes shone.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The eye contact got dangerously intense, and I shied off. Murphy let out a low, quiet laugh and touched the side of my face. Her fingers were warm, the touch light and delicate.
Thank you, Harry.
We came up to the second level of the garage together, walking with businesslike strides. The lights were out. In the depths of shadows, I could see two vans parked side by side. The first one was a beat-up old fossil of a vehicle, born in an era when people would have thought it absurd to make a van mini. A Red Cross decal on the driver's door proclaimed its identity. The second was a white rental van. We approached, and Kincaid slid the side door open. I couldn't see him very well in the shadows.
"Didn't take long," he commented. "You walk fast."
"Wheelman's here," I said. "He's coming up in an old Ford truck in a minute. Wanted to let you know first." Kincaid glanced at the ramp and nodded.
"Fine. What do we know?"
I told him. He took it all in without speaking, glanced once at the map Bob had drawn me, and said,
"Suicide."
"Hey?" I said. Kincaid shrugged.
"We go in there guns blazing, we're gonna get burned 2 feet from the door."
I tried to tell him that, Murphy said.
"So we get a plan," I said. "Any suggestions?"
"Blow up the building," Kincaid said without looking up. "That works good for vampires. Then soak what's left in gasoline, set it on fire, then blow it all up again."
For future reference, I was sort of hoping for a suggestion that didn't sound like it came from that Bolshevik Muppet with all the dynamite.
"Check," Kincaid said.
I peered at the van. "Hey, where are the Red Cross people?"
"I killed and dismembered them," Kincaid said.
I blinked. Kincaid stared at me for a second.
"That was a joke."
"Right," I said. "Sorry. Now, where are they?"
"On their lunch break. They somehow got the idea that I was a cop, and that they would interfere with a sting if they went into the shelter. I gave them a C-note and told them to go grab lunch."
"They believed you?" I asked.
"They somehow got the idea that I had a badge."
Murphy eyed Kincaid. "That's the kind of thing that's illegal to own." Kincaid turned to dig in the white van.
Sorry if I came afoul of your sensibilities, Lieutenant. Next time I'll let them walk in and get killed. I added the 100 to your bill, Dresden.
A dark jacket with a Red Cross logo on the shoulder flew out of the van and hit Murphy in the chest. She caught it, and a second later caught the matching baseball cap that followed.
Put them on, Kincaid said. Our ticket to get close enough to get the drop on them. Maybe even get some walking targets out of the way.
Where did you get those? I asked. Kincaid leaned out of the van, enough to arch an eyebrow at me.
Found them.
Kincaid, Murphy said, give me the keys to the Red Cross van.
Why?
So I can change, Murphy said, her voice tight. Kincaid shook his head.
You got nothing everyone here hasn't seen before, Lieutenant, he said.
After a moment he glanced at me and said,
Unless...
Yes, I said through clenched teeth. I've seen that sort of thing. It's been a while, but I dimly remember.
Just checking, Kincaid said.
Now give her the damn keys.
Yes, Master Dresden,
he said laconically, and tossed a ring with only two keys at Murphy. She caught it, let out a growling sound, and stalked over to the Red Cross van. She opened it and climbed in.
Not bad, Kincaid said,
low enough that Murphy wouldn't have heard him. He kept rooting around in the minivan, evidently without feeling any need for a light.
Her in a dress, I mean. Makes you notice she's a woman.
Shut up, Kincaid. I could hear the wolfish smile, even if I couldn't see it.
Yes, sir. Now don't look. I'm getting dressed and I blush easy.
Blow me, Kincaid, I growled.
Don't you owe me enough already?
I heard him moving around.
You give any more thought to shutting down Mauver's sorcery?
Yeah, I said. Ebenezer's truck growled as it changed gears. Our wheelman is going to handle it.
You sure he can?
Yeah, I said. Here he comes. Kincaid stepped out of the van with guns strapped all over attachment points on a suit of black ballistic body armor that looked a generation or two ahead of the latest police issue. He had one set of big-ass revolvers, a couple of those tiny deadly machine guns that shoot so fast they sound like a bandsaw, and a bunch of automatics. They all came in matching pairs, presumably because he had an audition for the lead in a John Woo movie later that day. Kincaid donned a second Red Cross jacket to help hide all the weaponry and added his own matching cap like Murphy's. He watched Ebenezer's truck coming and said,
So, who is this guy?
Just then, Ebenezer's truck rolled up, its headlights in our eyes until it had all but passed.
So, Hoss, Ebenezer was saying through the open window, who is this hired gun?
The old man and the mercenary saw one another and stared at each other from maybe 7 or 8 feet apart. Time stopped for one of those frozen, crystallized instants. And then both of them went for their guns, Chapter 30. Kincaid was faster. One of the guns he'd had on him got to his hand so quick it might have been teleported there from under his coat. But even as he raised the gun toward the old wizard, there was a flash of emerald light from a plain steel ring on Ebenezer's right hand. I felt a low, harsh hum in the air and a surge of dizziness, and Kincaid's pistol ripped its way out of his fingers and shot away into the shadows of the parking garage. I swayed on my feet. Kincaid recovered before I did, and a second gun came out from under the Red Cross jacket. I looked up to see Ebenezer settle the old shotgun stock against his shoulder, both barrels squarely on Kincaid's head. What the hell? I blurted and threw myself between them. It put Kincaid's pistol in line with my spine and Ebenezer's shotgun in line with my head, which seemed like a positive at the moment. As long as I was in front of the weapons, the two couldn't get a clean shot at each other. What the hell do you think you're doing? I demanded.
Hoss, snarled Ebenezer. You don't know what you're dealing with. Get down.
Put the shotgun down, I said. Kincaid, put the pistol away. Kincaid's voice behind me sounded no different than it had at breakfast.
That sounds like a fairly low percentage move for me, Dresden. No offense. I told you,
Ebenezer said, his voice different, cold and terrible and hard. I'd never heard the old man speak that way before.
I told you, if I ever saw you again, I'd kill you.
Which is one reason you haven't seen me, Kincaid answered.
There's no point to this. If we start shooting, the kid's gonna get hit. Neither of us has an interest in that. I'm supposed to believe you give a damn about him? Ebenezer snarled. Half a damn, maybe, Kincaid said. I sort of like him. But what I meant was there's no profit for either of us in killing him. Put the damn guns down, I choked, and stop talking about me like I'm a kid who isn't here. Why are you here? Ebenezer demanded, ignoring me. I'm a hired gun, Kincaid said. Dresden hired me. Do the math, Blackstaff. Of all people, you should know how it goes. The tone of Kincaid's voice changed to something thoughtful. But the kid doesn't know what we do, does he? Harry, get down, Ebenezer said, speaking to me again. You want me down, I said. I met Ebenezer's eyes and said, then I want your word you aren't going to open up on Kincaid until we've talked. Damn it, boy, I'm not giving my word to that. Anger made my voice lash out, hard and sharp. Not him. Give me your word, sir, now. The old man's gaze wavered, and he lifted his forward hand from the shotgun, fingers spread in a conciliatory gesture. He let the barrel ease down. All right. My word to you, Hoss. Kincaid exhaled slowly through his teeth. I felt his weight shift behind me. I glanced back. His gun was half lowered. Yours too, Kincaid. I'm working for you right now, Dresden, he said. You already have it. Then put the gun away. To my surprise, he did, though his empty eyes remained fastened on Ebenezer. What the hell was that about? I demanded. Defending myself, Kincaid said. Don't give me that crap, I said. Anger touched Kincaid's voice. It was a cold thing that lined his words with frost. Self-defense. If I'd known your fucking wheelman was Blackstaff McCoy, I'd have been in another state by now, Dresden. I want nothing to do with him. It's a little late for that now, I told him. I glared at Ebenezer. What are you doing? Taking care of a problem, the old man said. He kept his eyes on Kincaid while he drew the gun back into the truck. Harry, you don't know this. His mouth twisted with bitter revulsion. This thing, you don't know what it's done. You're one to talk, Kincaid replied. Gorgeous work at Casa Verde, by the way. Russian satellite for a measured response to Archangel. Very nice. I whirled on Kincaid. Stop it. Kincaid met my eyes, calm and defiant. Permission to engage in philosophical debate with the hypocrite, sir? Anger hit me in a red wave, and before I realized what I was doing, I was up in Kincaid's face, shoving my nose at his. Shut your mouth! Now! This man took me in when no one else would, and it probably saved my life. He taught me that magic, that life, was more than killing and power. You might be a badass, Kincaid, but you aren't worth the mud that falls off his goddamn boots. If it came to it, I'd trade your life for his without a second thought. And if I see you trying to provoke him again, I'll kill you myself. Do you understand me? There was a second where I felt the beginnings of the almost violent psychic pressure that accompanies a soul gaze. Kincaid must have felt it coming on, too. He let his eyes slip out of focus, turned away from me, and started unpacking a box in the van. I understand you, he said. I clenched my hands as hard as I could and closed my eyes. I tried not to move my lips while I counted to 10 and got the blaze of my temper under control. After a few seconds, I took a couple of steps back from Kincaid and shook my head. I leaned against the fender of Ebenezer's old Ford and got myself under control. Blazing anger had gotten me into way too many bad situations, historically speaking. I knew better than to indulge it like that, but at the same time, it felt good to let off a little steam. And damn it, I'd had a good reason to slap Kincaid down. I couldn't believe that he would have the temerity to compare himself to my old teacher, in any sense. Hell, from what Ebenezer had said, Kincaid wasn't even human.
I'm sorry, I said a minute later, that he was trying to push your buttons, sir. There was a significant beat before Ebenezer answered.
It's nothing, Hoss, he said. His voice was rough. No need to apologize.
I looked up and stared at the old man. He wouldn't meet my eyes. Not because he was afraid of a soul gaze beginning, either. He'd insisted on it within an hour of meeting me. I still remembered it as sharply as every other time I'd looked on someone's soul. I still remembered the old man's oak tree strength, his calm, his dedication to doing what he felt was right. And more than simply looking like a decent person, Ebenezer had lived an example for an angry and confused young wizard. Justin DeMorn had taught me how to do magic, but it was Ebenezer who had taught me why. That magic came from the heart, from the essence of what the wizard believed, from who and what he chose to be. That the power born into any wizard carried with it the responsibility to use it to help his fellow man. That there were things worth protecting, defending, and that the world could be more than a jungle where the strong thrived and the weak were devoured. Ebenezer was the only man on the planet to whom I regularly applied an honorific. As far as I was concerned, he was the only one who truly deserved it. But a soul gaze wasn't a lie detector test. It shows you the core of another person, but it doesn't shine lights into every shadowy corner of the human soul. It doesn't mean that they can't lie to you. Ebenezer avoided my eyes, and he looked ashamed. There's work to be done, Ebenezer, I said in a measured tone. I don't know what you know about Kincaid, but he knows his business. I asked him here. I need his help.
Yes, Ebenezer agreed.
I need yours too, I said. Are you in?
Yes, he said.
I thought I heard something like pain in his voice.
Of course.
Then we move now. We talk later.
Fine.
I nodded. Murphy had appeared at some point, now dressed in jeans, a dark shirt, and the Red Cross hat and jacket Kincaid had given her. She had her gun belt on, and she held herself a little differently, so I figured she had strapped on her Kevlar vest. All right, I said, stepping over to the van. Ebenezer is going to shut down Mavra, or at least throw a wet blanket over anything she can do. You got everything you need, sir? Ebenezer grunted in the affirmative and patted a pair of old leather saddlebags he had tossed over his shoulder. Right, I said. That means that our main problems should be the Renfields and their Darkhounds, guns and teeth. We'll want to get inside and down to the basement if we can. Then, if bullets start flying, it should keep them from killing people upstairs and next door.
What's the rest of the plan? Kincaid asked.
Kill the vampires, save the hostages, I said.
For the record, Kincaid said, I was hoping for an answer that vaguely hinted at a specific tactical doctrine, rather than spouting off general campaign objectives.
I started to snap at him, but reined in my temper. This wasn't the time for it.
You've done this the most, I said. What do you suggest?
Kincaid looked at me for a moment and then nodded. He glanced at Murphy and said,
Something in a Mossberg. Can you handle a shotgun?
Yeah, Murphy said. These are close quarters, though. We'd need something heavy like that to stop a charge, but the barrel would need to be cut short. Kincaid gave her a look and said,
That would be an illegal weapon.
Then he reached into the van and handed her a shotgun with a barrel that had been cut down to end just above the forward grip. Murphy snorted and checked out the shotgun while Kincaid rattled around in the white minivan again. Instead of a second shotgun, though, he drew a weapon made of plain, non-reflective steel from the van. It was modeled after a boar spear of the Middle Ages, a shaft about 5 feet long with a cross brace thrusting out on two sides at the base of the spear tip, a foot and a half of deadly, matte black blade as wide as my hand at the base and tapering down to a fine point at the tip. There was enough mass to the spear to make me think that he could as easily chop and slash with the edges of the spearhead as thrust with the tip. The butt end of the spear ended at some kind of bulbous-looking cap of metal, maybe just a counterweight. A similar double protrusion bulged out from the spear shaft at the base of the blade.
Spear and magic helmet, I said in my best Elmer Fudd voice. Be very, very quiet. We're hunting vampires.
Kincaid gave me the kind of smile that would make dogs break into nervous howls.
You got your stick ready there, Dresden?
You should go with a shotgun, Murphy told Kincaid. Kincaid shook his head.
Can't shove the shotgun into a charging vampire or hellhound and hold them off with a cross brace, he said.
He settled a spear into his grip and did something to the handle. The beam of a flashlight clicked on from one side of the bulge at the base of the spearhead. He tapped the other one with a finger.
Besides, got incendiary rounds loaded zip-gun style in either end. If I need them, bang.
In the butt end, too? I asked. He reversed his grip on the spear and showed me the metal casing.
Pressure trigger on that one, he said.
Kincaid dropped the spear's point down and held the haft close to his body, somehow managing to make the weapon look like a casual and appropriate accessory.
Shove it hard against the target and boom. Based it on the bang sticks those National Geographic guys made for diving with sharks.
I looked from the gadget-readied spear and body armor to my slender staff of plain old wood and leather duster. My dick is bigger than your dick, I said.
Heh, Kincaid said.
He draped a rope of garlic around his neck, then tossed another one to me and a third to Murphy. Murphy eyed the garlic.
I thought the vampires were going to be asleep. I mean, they staked Dracula in his coffin, right?
You're thinking of the movie, Kincaid said.
He passed me a web belt with a canteen and a pouch on it. The pouch contained a medical kit, a roll of duct tape, a road flare, and a flashlight. The canteen had masking tape on the lid, and block letters in permanent marker identified it as holy water.
Read the book. Older or stronger members of the Black Court might not be totally incapacitated by sunlight.
Might not even inconvenience Mavra, I said. Stoker's Dracula ran around in broad daylight. But between daylight and Ebenezer, Mavra shouldn't have much in the way of powers. If there are any Black Court on their feet who want to come for us, I'll have to do it the dirty way.
Which is why I got you a surprise, Dresden.
Oh, good, I said. A surprise. That's sure to be fun. Kincaid reached into the van and presented me with a futuristic-looking weapon, a gun. It had a round tank the size of a gumball machine attached to its frame, and for a second I thought I'd been handed a pistol-sized flamethrower. Then I recognized it, cleared my throat, and said, "This is a paintball gun."
"It's a high-tech weapon," he said, "and it isn't loaded with paint. The ammunition is interspersed holy water and garlic loads. It'll hurt and frighten dark hounds, and it'll chew holes in any vamps that are moving around."
While not putting any holes in us, Murphy chimed in, or in innocent bystanders.
Okay, I said, but this is a paintball gun.
It's a weapon, Murphy said, and a weapon that will do harm to the bad guys while not hurting your allies. That makes it a damn good one for you, for such close quarters. You're good in a fight, but you don't have close-quarters firearms or military training, Harry. Without ingrained fire discipline, you're as likely to kill one of us as the bad guys.
She's right, Kincaid said. Relax, Dresden. It's sound technology and a good tool for teamwork. We do this simple. I'm on point, then the shotgun, then you, Dresden. I see a Renfield with a gun, and I'm going to drop flat. Murphy handles it from there. If we get a vampire or a dark hound, I'll crouch and hold it off with a spear. The two of you hit it with everything you can. Push it back until I can pin it on the spear, then kill it.
How? Murphy asked. Stakes?
Screw stakes, Kincaid said. He held out a heavy machete in an olive drab sheath to Murphy. Take off its head.
She clipped the machete onto her belt.
Gotcha.
The three of us together should be able to take one vamp down the hard way if we're alert. But if one of them closes on us, we are probably going to die, Kincaid said. The best way to stay alive is to hit them fast and stay on the offensive. Once we've put down any unfriendlies, you two can go save the hostages or take the Renfields to therapy or tap dance or whatever. If things go south, stay together and come straight back out. McCoy should have the truck out front and ready where he can see the door.
I will, Ebenezer agreed.
Okay, Kincaid said. Anyone have any questions?
Why do they sell hot dogs in packages of 10, but hot dog buns in packages of 8? I said. Everyone glared at me. I should probably leave off wizarding and chase my dream of becoming a stand-up comedian. Instead, I put the toy gun in my right hand, my staff in my left, and said, "Let's go." Chapter 31. I drove the Red Cross van up to the shelter. I pulled in right in front, put it in park, and said, "You two go in first. I'm sure whoever the vamps have working for them will recognize me, at least by description. Outside chance they'll know Murph, too, but the uniform might make them play along until you can get any bystanders out of the building."
"How should I do that?" Kincaid asked.
"Hell's bells, you're the big-time mercenary. What am I paying you for?" I said, annoyed. "What's unit response time down here, Murphy?"
"This is gang country. Officially about 6 minutes. Reality is more like 10 or 15, maybe more.
So we call it 6 or 7 minutes to get clear after someone calls CPD, screaming about rabid dogs and gunfire," I said. "The longer before that happens, the better. So get it done calmly and quietly, Kincaid. Talk them out if you can."
"No problem," Kincaid said, and leaned his spear against the dashboard. "Let's go."
Murphy held her weapon down and close to her side and followed Kincaid into the building. I waited, but I had already planned to go on in if I didn't hear anything in the next minute or so. I started counting to 60. On 44, the door opened, and a couple of bedraggled men and 3 or 4 raggedly dressed women, all of them more beaten down than actually aged, came shambling out.
"Like I said, it shouldn't take long,"
Kincaid was saying in a bluff, heavy, cheerful voice marked with the harder, shorter vowels of a Chicago accent. He came along behind the street folk, shepherding them out.
"It's probably just a faulty detector. As soon as the guys from the gas company check out the basement and make sure it's safe, we'll get set up and get everyone paid. 1 hour, tops."
"Where is Bill?" demanded one of the women in a querulous voice.
"Bill is the man from the Red Cross. You aren't Bill."
"Vacation," Kincaid said. His good-natured smile did not touch his eyes. They remained cold and uncaring as he reached through the van's window and picked up his spear.
The woman took one look at his expression, another at the weapon, then ducked her head and scurried away from the shelter. The others followed suit, scattering like a covey of quail alerted to a sudden danger. I went inside and Kincaid backed in after me, shutting the door. The reception area looked more like a security checkpoint. A small room, a couple of chairs, a heavy security door, and a guard station behind a window of heavy bars. But the security door had been propped open with one of the chairs, and I could see Murphy standing in the room on the other side, her riot gun held level, her stance alert and ready. I walked over to her. The room beyond the reception area was the size of a small cafeteria. Cubicle walls sprouted in one corner like some kind of crystalline growth. Half a dozen people, dressed in business casual, stood passively against the nearest cubicle wall, and Murphy had her gun leveled at them. They should have been afraid. They weren't. They just stood there, eyes dull, faces set in vacant, bovine expressions.
"Harry," she said, "Kincaid said we shouldn't let them out until you made sure they weren't dangerous."
"Yeah," I said. I hated to think of leaving simple thralls staring stupidly at nothing, given all the violence on the immediate agenda, but that would have been better than setting some bloodthirsty Renfield loose somewhere behind me. I closed my eyes for a moment, concentrating. There were 1,000 other things I would rather do than examine victims of the Black Court with my sight, but we didn't have time for anything else. I opened my eyes along with my sight and focused on the people standing in line. I don't know if you've ever seen a sheep slaughtered for mutton. The process isn't fast, even if it isn't really cruel. They make the sheep lie down on its side and cover its eyes. The sheep lies there without struggling, and the shepherd takes a sharp knife and draws a single, neat line across its throat. The sheep jerks in a sharp twitch of surprise while the shepherd holds it gently down. It smells blood and stirs more. Then the animal quiets again under the shepherd's hand. It bleeds.
It doesn't look real the first time you see it, because the blood is too bright and thick, and the animal isn't struggling. There's a lot of blood. It spreads out on the ground, soaking into dirt or sand. It dyes the wool of the sheep's chest, throat, and legs a dark, rusty red. Sometimes the blood gets into a puddle around its nose, and the animal's breaths make scarlet ripples. Before the end, the sheep might twitch and jerk another time or two, but it's silent, and it doesn't really make an effort to fight. It lies there, becoming more still, and after several minutes that stroll past in no great hurry, it dies. That's what they looked like to my sight, those people the vampires had enthralled. They stood calmly, relaxed, thinking of nothing. Like sheep, they had been blindfolded to the truth somehow. Like sheep, they did not struggle or flee. Like sheep, they were being kept for whatever benefit their lives would provide. And like sheep, they would eventually be taken for food. I saw them, defenseless and beaten, blood soaking into their clothing while they lay still under the hand of a being more powerful than they. They stood quietly, dying like sheep, or rather, five of them did. The sixth was a Renfield. For the briefest second, I saw the sixth victim, a burly man of middle years and wearing a blue Oxford shirt, as a sheep like the rest of them. Then that image vanished, replaced by something inhuman. His face looked twisted and deformed, and his muscles swelled hideously, bulging with blackened veins and quivering with unnatural power. There was a band of shimmering, vile energy wreathing his throat in an animal's collar, the reflection of the dark magic that had enslaved him. But worst of all were his eyes. The man's eyes looked as if they had been clawed out by something with tiny, scalpel-sharp talons. I met his blind gaze, and there was nothing there. Nothing. Just an empty darkness so vast and terrible that my lungs froze and my breath locked in my throat. By the time I realized what I was seeing, the man had already let out a feral shriek and charged me. I shouted in surprise and tried to back up, but he was simply too fast. He backhanded me. The enchantments on my duster diverted much of the power in it, so it didn't crack any of my ribs, but it was still strong enough to throw me from my feet and into a wall. I dropped to the floor, stunned. An angel, blazing with fury and savage strength, spun toward the Renfield, her eyes shining with azure flame, a shaft of fire in her hands. The angel was dressed in soiled robes, smudged with smoke and blood and filth, no longer white. She bled from half a dozen wounds and moved as if in terrible pain. Murphy. There was a peal of thunder, and flame leapt from the shaft of light in her hands. The Renfield, now deformed with muscle like some kind of madman's gargoyle, accepted the blow and batted the shaft of light from the angel's hands. She dove for the weapon. The Renfield followed, reaching for her neck. Something hit it hard, a second shaft, though this one was made not of light, but of what looked like solidified smog of black and deep purple. The blow drove the Renfield from its feet, and the angel recovered the fallen weapon. Another shaft of light thundered into the Renfield's head, and it collapsed abruptly to the ground. I shook my head, trying to tear away from the painful clarity of my sight. I heard a footstep nearby. Still stunned, I looked behind me. For just a second, I saw something standing there. Something enormous, malformed, something silent and merciless and deadly. It had to crouch to keep from brushing the ceiling with the horns curling away from its head and bat-like wings spread from its shoulders to fall around it and behind it to drag along the floor. And I thought I saw some kind of hideous double image lurking behind it like the corpse specter of death himself. Then the second was past. I pushed my sight away and Kincaid stood frowning down at me. I said, "Are you all right?" "Yeah," I said. "Yeah, just clipped me." Kincaid offered me his hand. I didn't take it. I pushed myself to my feet instead. His expression became opaque. It had an alien quality to it that made it more frightening than when it had been merely unreadable. He stepped over to the body of the middle-aged man in the blue Oxford shirt and jerked his spear out of the corpse. It was wet with blood all the way to the cross brace. I shuddered but asked Murphy, "You okay?" She still gripped the riot gun as she stood over the body, keeping her eyes on the five people remaining. There was a bloody, pulpy mess where the first shot had ripped open the man's leg, but it hadn't even slowed him down. It was messier where Murphy's second shot had torn into his head. Not that he would have been any better off if she'd hit him in the chest. People don't survive direct hits from shotguns delivered from a couple of steps away. "Murph?" I asked. "Fine," she said. Some of the Renfield's blood had sprayed onto her cheek, beading into red droplets below her distant eyes. "I'm fine. What now?" Kincaid stepped up beside Murphy and put his hand on the end of the riot gun's barrel. He pushed gently, and she shot him a look before taking a steadying breath and lowering the weapon. Kincaid nodded at the remaining thralls. "I'll get these five out and meet you at the stairs. Don't go down without me." "Don't worry," I said. "We won't." He prodded the five thralls into motion and herded them out of the building. I oriented myself on the room's doors, remembering Bob's handy-dandy map, and headed for the door that led down to the basement. Murphy walked beside me. She said nothing, but fed two more shells into the riot gun. She reached for the doorknob. "I put mine there first." "Hold it, Murph," I said. "Let me check it for surprises." She looked at me for a second and then nodded. I closed my eyes and laid my hand on the door, gently pushing my awareness through the door, feeling silently for patterns of energy that might indicate magical wards like the ones protecting my apartment. My magical awareness was akin to the sight, just as my sense of touch was akin to my sense of sight. It cost me less than opening the sight, and was infinitely more gentle to my psyche. I felt nothing. No waiting wards or pre-readied traps of Mavra's deadly black magic. Generally speaking, the bad guys weren't terribly interested in learning defensive magic when they could be out blowing things up instead, but I was determined not to get sucker punched on something that basic. "He was already gone," I told Murphy. She said nothing. "I saw him, Murph. I saw him. There wasn't anything left inside him. He was less than an animal. There was nothing else you could have done." She spoke very quietly. "Shut the fuck up, Harry." I did. I finished my check, felt around for the presence of any supernatural entities that might be right on the other side of the door, and listened to boot. Nothing. When I opened my eyes again, Kincaid was standing there with Murphy. I hadn't heard his approach. "Clear?" he asked. I nodded. "The door isn't warded. I don't think there's anything waiting on the other side, but I can't be sure." Kincaid grunted, glanced at Murphy, then leaned back and kicked the door open. Murphy blinked at me. Kincaid was a big guy, sure, but it's tough to kick doors down on the first try. I'd seen men batter one with those same vicious kicks for 15 minutes before the door gave way. Maybe he'd just gotten lucky. "Yeah, I believed that." The image of that enormous, demonic thing that had crouched in the mercenary's place loomed with a terrible clarity in my head. Kincaid landed on balance, lifted the spear, and pointed the head and its attached flashlight down the closed, narrow stairway. There was only silence. And then the sound of a soft, mocking laugh from somewhere in the darkness below us. Hell's bells. The back of my neck crawled up my scalp and into one ear. "Form up," I murmured, because it sounded more military and tougher than saying, "You guys go first." Kincaid nodded and took a step down. Murphy readied the riot gun again and pressed in behind him. I picked up my air-powered pop gun and followed her. "Where are they keeping the hostages again?" Murphy asked. "In a closet at the bottom of the stairs, on the right." "That was hours ago," Kincaid said quietly. "They could be anywhere now. Once we go down there, there's no room for playing around."
The hostages are our first concern.
Screw that. That's exactly why the vamps took hostages in the first place, Kincaid said. If you let them dictate your tactics, they're going to use it to kill you.
That isn't your concern, I said. Kincaid's voice became quieter and harder.
It is when I'm standing this close to you. They might get me instead.
That's why you get the big bucks.
He shook his head. We don't even know if they're alive. Look, this is a basement. All we have to do is roll down the grenades and then go mop up whatever is left afterward. We're underground. The collateral damage will be minimal.
That's not good enough, I said. We save the hostages first. Once they're clear, then we take care of business with Mavra.
Kincaid glanced over his shoulder at me, his eyes narrow and cold. Defiance and contempt rang in every word.
It might be a little harder to rescue them if we're dead.
Murphy put the mouth of the riot gun against Kincaid's spine and said, "How good is that armor?"
Sometimes Murphy has a way with words. We were all quiet for a couple of seconds. Then I said,
"We might get killed trying to save the hostages. We will get killed if we don't stick together.
Do the math, Kincaid, or break your agreement and get out."
He stared at Murphy for a second, and then relented, turning back to face the stairway.
"Fine," he said. "We do it your way. It's amateur night."
We started down the first flight of stairs together, while whatever waited in the darkness below us laughed again.